I knew I could be happy. Now, I pictured those big houses, and I assume all of you live in them, the big white houses up on top of hills. And they all had columns out in front. Now, I thought if I could get me into a house like that with those columns out in front, I knew I could be happy. And inside every one of those houses, there was a huge, sweeping circular staircase. And every night, the heroine went to the ball. And she would come sweeping down the staircase with her crinolines and her starched skirts, and underneath the stairs somewhere would be a 40-piece orchestra secreted, playing beautiful music. And as she swept off into the arms of Prince Charming, she was happy. Now, I thought, if only I could do that, I could be happy. The few winter nights that she did not go to the ball, she'd sit upstairs in her bedroom, and every one of those bedrooms had a large fireplace, and she'd sit right there next to the fireplace in her wing chair, and she would read love poetry. Now, I thought, that's for me. If I could get me into a place where I could sit around in the evenings and read love poetry, couldn't I be happy? Now, the only problem with this wishful kind of reading is that when you close the book, where are you? You're still sitting in three rooms behind your father's store in Haverhill, Massachusetts. And the only column that we had out front was the rotating barber pole for the shop next door. The only staircase we had was a ladder that dropped through a trap door into the oil tank room where I personally pumped kerosene by the gallon for the customers. And the only fireplace we had was the little gas grate in the bedroom where all five of us slept in layers. Now, this was hardly that elegant plantation living that I longed for. And so as I looked around, I said to myself, somehow I've got to get out of here. I knew that within me beat the heart of a queen just waiting to get out. And I figured, somehow, I have got to become what I want me to be. So all during high school, I didn't go to any of the dances or the proms or any of the other things that all the other girls did. I just stayed home and studied. Now, this was not totally a thirst for knowledge. It was partly the fact that no one ever asked me out. I don't know what you looked like in high school. Everybody here seems to be a beauty queen, but in Haverhill, we didn't all look that good. And so as I looked around, I realized since no one was asking me out, I might as well study. So I worked very hard on the book so that by the time I got through high school, I was on the high honor roll, had all A's, got a state scholarship to the university, and I was very proud of the fact that I was going off to college. And I knew that if I could only achieve my first goal, which was to become well-educated, I knew I could be happy. So I started right off to get educated. And when I got to college, I had taken a ride across the state of Massachusetts on a Greyhound bus, and I really thought that if you got on at one end and got off at the other, you'd be a transformed person. Now, I want to tell you, any of you want to try that, it doesn't work. I got off the same little girl I was when I got on, carrying all of my worldly possessions in two shopping bags with little rope handles. And there I got off the bus in Amherst, Massachusetts, and I started out to become educated. Now, I got there, and I loved to study, so this was exciting for me. I worked very hard to study. I figured no one will know that I come from that three rooms behind the store, where we ate right in full view of all the customers, and where to go from the bedroom to the bathroom, you had to pass by the cash register. And so as I got there to college, I thought, I will now become an elite person, and people won't notice where I've come from, and they won't see that I'm not quite as refined and cultured as the rest of the girls here. Now, the only problem with this, as I got into a sorority, I began to realize that actually I didn't know how to do some of the finer things of life, which all of you Southern beauties, I'm sure, know how to do. I'm sure all these things came naturally to you. But you see, when you lived in three rooms behind a store and ate right out there in front of the customers, you didn't need to know how to make a centerpiece. I mean, our centerpiece was the milk bottle. And my mother, on a fancy meal, would take the milk bottle off the table and put it under the table. I didn't know anything about which way to place the candelabra. We didn't have candelabra. I didn't know anything about piling mints in those little bonbon dishes in spirals so they would come up to the top, and when I'd put the mint on, the whole thing would fall off the edge. And I had no idea how to pour tea from a silver pot. I didn't even know that coffee outranks tea, so if I was asked to pour tea, I didn't even know enough to be insulted. Now, you see, when you don't know these things, how can you function? And so I realized that I had to become a gracious lady. Because if you don't know these things, without which you cannot be a social success, how are you going to get on in life? And I thought, what difference does it make to have all these brains if I don't know how to do things in a gracious and refined manner? So I took all the books out of the library that I possibly could in order that I could study etiquette, learn how to pour tea and make all those little arrangements and the important things. And as I studied all those, I also took modeling lessons so I could learn to do pivot turns and not fall over. And I practiced I practiced rising from chairs gracefully and doing all the things that I felt were going to make me into the kind of person that would make me happy. Now, by the time I finished 4 years in college, I had achieved all of these things I'd set out to do. I was totally educated. I had a full major in English, a full major in education, a full major in speech, and a minor in psychology. So by the time I got through, I thought anyone who's done all that must be brilliant. In fact, all through my life, there had been that hope because I had two adorable brothers, and everywhere we go, people would look at them and say, aren't they so cute and precious? And then they would look at me, and there would be the 30-second assessment, and they'd say to my mother, I hope she's smart. So right from the start, I knew I had better get smart. It was all I had hopeful to go for. So I worked very hard to get smart. So by the time I graduated from college with an honors degree in speech, I felt, well, I really now am totally educated, and besides that, I've also made myself into a gracious lady. And then I set out for my third goal in life, which was to get a great job and have a lot of money. They went together. I thought, if you get this marvelous job and you have all this money, then surely you will be happy. And so I did. I went right back to Haverhill High School and got a job there teaching English and speech. Now, is there anyone here that's ever been to Haverhill? Every once in a while I find someone. You've been to Haverhill? Do you live there or just pass through? Just pass through. Best thing to do with Haverhill. Pass right through it. So I went back to Haverhill, and the main reason I went back there was the fact that I figured I had spent so much time making myself wonderful, it would be really a shame not to let the home folks see what had happened. So I went back to Haverhill, and I taught there in the high school, and I got $1,800 a year. Now, at that time, that was pretty big money, and that was in 1949, and for those of you who want to figure out my age, I did once skip a grade, so you can delete one from your total. So as I got this marvelous job in 1949, earning $1,800 a year, I was very happy that I had all this money, because now that had achieved my third goal. Now, my fourth goal, then, was to become well-dressed. Now, for those few of you as old as I here who do remember the Depression, you know that clothes, we didn't have a lot of clothes. In fact, my clothes were always, my mother always taught me that everything I had should be so dull and nondescript that people would never realize I was wearing the same thing all the time. So, consequently, I had what you'd call a beige childhood. My clothes were so dull that you could put me up against the wall of any given room and I blended right in with the wallpaper. So when I got all this money, I set out to become well-dressed. And I went into Filene's basement in Boston. I assume if you've been to Haverhill, you've probably been to Filene's basement, two of a kind. And so I went in there to Filene's, where they mark everything down 25% every 7 days. And you watch the thing go down. You try to buy it just before they give it away to the Salvation Army. And they try everything on right out in the aisles, right? And they strip everything off. And my brother told me he never minded meeting me in Boston as long as we met at the bra counter of Filene's basement, because it was always something to watch. And so as I went into Filene's buying all these wonderful things at very reasonable prices, I was able within 1 year to buy 40 dresses, 35 suits, and 30 pairs of shoes, and I then proclaimed myself to be the best dressed woman in Haverhill, Massachusetts. Now, unfortunately, there's someone here that's been to Haverhill and knows that that's not quite such a trick as it might appear to be. But I was very happy with myself because now I had achieved four things. I was totally educated, a gracious lady, had all this money in this job, and I now was the best dressed woman in Haverhill. And my children and my pupils kept book on how many days I could go without wearing the same thing twice. So I was very happy that they were very focusing on me because I knew if everybody paid attention to me enough, I really could be happy. So as I thought of all these things I had achieved, I thought, now this is really great. What is there that I'm missing in life? Because I still didn't feel quite happy. And I thought, well, you really, not everybody knows you in town. You should become popular. Because what good does it do to have all this brains and this charm and grace and to have all these clothes and money if nobody sees you? So I thought, I have to get some visibility. So I began to try to become popular in town. And so I joined all of the clubs. I went through what I now think of as my presidential period. I can see that some of you relate to that. You must have all done that one. So I became president of everything. I once became president of the Connecticut Speech and Drama Association on the first meeting before I joined. So I learned how to be in charge of everything. And everywhere I went, I always was able to take charge. And I also learned that one of the best ways to become popular in town is to have your picture in the paper lot. And so I got a real affinity for cameras. And as I saw any photographer, I would head right in that direction. And one of the things, should you be still trying to do this yourself and haven't achieved this yet, one of the things to remember is you always wear a dress that's a plain color, should have something around the neck to flatter you. And when you get your picture taken, you always stand sideways like this. You look much slimmer. And the best thing to do, if possible, is to try to place yourself right between two chubby little ladies in flower dresses. I can tell that's the most valuable thing you've learned since you got here. by doing this, you're able to be the one that looks the best, and people begin to see your picture in the paper line. Pretty soon you become well known. So it got so that when I was able to walk down Merrimack Street in Haverhill, Massachusetts, that everybody knew, there goes Miss Chapman. So I thought, well, that's good if you've achieved that in life. Now, at this point, I was 23 years old. I had achieved all these goals I wanted, totally educated, gracious lady, great job, wonderful money, best-dressed woman in Haverhill, and now everybody knew me. I've been president of everything in town. Now, there's not much more you want to do, except there is one fear that begins to creep into the heart of a single English teacher in Haverhill, Massachusetts. And what's that? What if you can never find a man? Now, that fear began to grip me. Now, I had been so busy up to that point making myself wonderful that I hadn't any chance to look for men. And unfortunately, none were looking for me. My daughters look at my pictures at that point, and they can see, I see why nobody was looking for you. Now, I began to look around town. Now, for some of you who have worked the same program that I have in self-improvement, you realize that one great problem with having made yourself perfect is that there are very few men left that are good enough for you. And after all that work, you sure don't want to marry downhill. So I looked around town to see what I could find, and there were actually only two men that I felt were qualified. One of them was a local doctor, and he had four things going for him. He'd gone to Harvard Med School, Phillips Andover Academy. His father was president of the bank, and he was an only child and sure to inherit the family fortune. Now, for me, in those days, those were four very strong credentials for marriage. Now, there were only two things wrong with him. One was he had a strange and unusual attachment to his mother. And the other one was that he was ugly. I used to look at him and I'd say to myself, could you wake up every day, the rest of your life, and look at him and be happy? I see the very thought of that turned me in the other direction to the only other single man in town who was the local priest. Now, he was tall, dark, and handsome. He looked as if he was about to sing the lead and Going My Way. I took a look at him, and I thought, what a waste. Now, in those days, one did not dare set one's heart on the local priest. So I continued to date the doctor for a year, at the end of which time he told me he was going to stay home with his mother, which is where he is today. I check up on him now and then. He's still home with his mother. The father died removing the triangle, but he's still home with his mother. And at the very same time, and this is the truth, at that very same time, the priest ran away and married one of his parishioners. Scandal of Haverhill. And I found out that I had put my attention in the wrong direction. I mean, if I had only pursued him, I might today be a mother superior. Now, that eliminated all the men in Haverhill. So that summer, I went off to the woods of Maine, and I went up there every summer to teach drama in a very fancy summer camp. And when we became counselors, we had to all wear little costumes. And if you can picture me, little baggy navy blue pants, they even weren't too little, kind of baggy navy blue pants, a white man's shirt with a necktie, and a V-necked, itchy navy blue wool vest. And right on the front of it, a large white felt pine tree was appliqued on here, obliterating what little shape I had. And on the top of the pine tree, a large T, which stood for tree boar, that's the name of the camp, Robert spelled backwards. Now, you don't have to write it out, believe me. Robert spelled backwards was the name of the camp. They had it backwards on Robert. And so here it was with the T right there. Now, on my hat, a head, a little hat, and another pine tree and another T. There I was in this little costume. And one Friday night in August, Janice, the sailing counselor, dressed in an identical outfit, we looked like a pair of bookends, and off we went to Howard Johnson's, the social mecca of the area. Now, you picture something different from what it really was, because it didn't even have an orange roof. It was just a little gray shanty hanging over the edge of a stagnant pond full of floating fudgicle wrappers. And there in that unlikely setting, Janice and I draped ourselves seductively over a rock in front of Howard Johnson's and began looking for action. I can tell some of you have done that. Now, as I looked, much to my amazement, over the bridge, over the stagnant pond, through the mist, came a tall, handsome young man. And I looked up and I said to myself, that has got to be the best-looking thing you've seen in the woods of Maine in many a summer. And I tried to figure out how I was going to get to meet him. So as I sat there in the rock, I reviewed my life quickly and all the things I'd done to get ready for this great moment. One of the things was my father had taught us from the time we were very young to be able to speak quickly, to articulate correctly, to have a large vocabulary, to pronounce words well. And he had run us through many things so that from the time we were 3 years old, when I first recited the entire second chapter of Luke for the Sunday school Christmas pageant, he had taught us things such as people who live in transparent domiciles should refrain from hurling geological specimens promiscuously. At 3 years old, we all could recite that. And also, before we went to kindergarten, we had to learn, in case the teacher asked us a question we didn't know the answer, we had to memorize, not knowing to any degree of accuracy, I dare not assert for fear of erring therein. Now, when you can quickly say things like that, you can fit in just anywhere in life. So I had worked those over, and so I began to review those in my head. I did a few mental pivot turns, and as I began to think about this, he came over close to me, and amazingly enough, Janice, the sailing counselor, had gone to college with his brother and sister-in-law that were with him, and they jumped up together and had this marvelous reunion. So I thought, this is my grand chance. And so I rose gracefully from the rock, did a pivot turn, and looked up at him and began to speak to him in my flawless English with my large vocabulary. Now, he did ask me out, and I found out later it wasn't my charm or grace, it was the fact that he needed a date. He didn't know a single girl in the woods of Maine. And he could tell I was, if nothing else, obviously single. So we did go out. He made an arrangement to come up and see me in a few weeks, and when he came up to visit me, he told me after being there for a day that I think you're really a nice girl, but I know I could never marry you. Now, I wasn't getting any younger, and I thought I shouldn't make any more mistakes, so I asked him what was wrong with me. And he said, well, there's nothing really that wrong with you. It's just that I'm a businessman. I have to make a business-like proposition. And he said, when I figure how many miles it is from Larchmont, New York, to Haverhill, Massachusetts, how many miles my car gets to the gallon, how much gas is a gallon, he multiplied all this out like a computer in his head. And then he said, if I were going to date you properly, and Fred always did everything properly, not a lot of fun, but properly. And he said, if I were going to date you properly, I'd have to come up twice a month, he doubled the amount, throw in a little bit of a depreciation in lunches, and he said, frankly, when I look at that figure and then at yours, I don't think it's worth the investment. Now, I was really discouraged at that point. And I told my brothers, and they said, well, we don't like stodgy old Fred anyway. He hasn't any sense of humor, and in our house, if you didn't have a sense of humor, you weren't worth anything. And we spent most of our time sitting around trying to be funny and top each other. And so when we found out that Fred couldn't even tell jokes, my brother said, let's forget stodgy old Fred. So I dropped all my pseudo-manners and my pivot turns, and I began to behave the way I had before Fred came along. So after another day, he said to me, ever since I told you I couldn't get married to you, you seem to have shaped up. He said, I was wondering if I could stay another day or two and see if you continue to improve. Now, that puts you right at ease. And so I said, well, fine, I'm sure most of you beauties would have sent him packing, but you weren't in my situation of being a single English teacher in Haverhill, Massachusetts, without much chance. So I said, yes, he could stay, because he was very, very handsome. And so he did stay for another day, and then he said, you have changed so much that I am going to put you on a 3 months probation period. And that's what he did. So we dated, he never mentioned marriage again, and we just, he came up twice a month properly, as he said he would, and everything went along, and after another year, he took me for a ride in Central Park in New York City in one of those cabs with the driver with the tall hat and the whip, the horses, the whole thing, and as we're trotting through Central Park, he handed me a box and it had a white orchid and this diamond ring. Now this diamond ring may not be the biggest thing here, but it was definitely the biggest one in Haverhill. And so I went back to Haverhill, and not being anyone to do things in a small way, I gathered all my pupils together, and I announced from the platform of the auditorium on Monday afternoon, Miss Chapman is going to get married. Now, in those days, pupils liked their teachers, and they all volunteered to help with the wedding. And I thought this was wonderful, never being someone to turn down free labor. I thought this was a great idea. And so I put them all into committees. I figured we already had committees from the drama department, and so I would run my wedding as a giant-sized senior class play. So we got all the committees moving. We decided, since it was the year that Queen Elizabeth was crowned, and I had meant to be a queen anyway, that we would do my whole wedding as a coronation. And so we did. The household arts teacher tatted me a crown, big circles of tatting all starched and glued with pearls. And the woodshop boys cut up broomsticks and sprayed them gold for the bridesmaids, for scepters. And the metal shop boys made big display racks, and we let everybody know ahead of time that not only would your gift be on display at the wedding, but your name would be written under it. There is no better way to increase the value of wedding gifts than to have the name written right under them. And we had the household arts girls plan the royal buffet. The auto body boys found me a white Cadillac to drive me to and from the wedding. And the high school band began to practice the wedding march with my brother at first trumpet. Now, as we got all these things going, we met every Monday afternoon, and everybody came in with new ideas. Pretty soon, we had 500 people on the committees. And at that point, you can imagine how many different ideas 500 teenagers can come up with. And so we got this wedding. I wanted to make sure that no one in Haverhill would ever forget this wedding. And they never did. 20 years after I'd been married, it was in the paper. 20 years ago today, Florence Chapman got married. So I wanted to make sure that no one would ever forget this. That at the end, towards the end, one of my more creative pupils wrote into Life magazine and they said, how would you like to come and cover a teacher's wedding where the pupils are doing all the work? And much to our amazement, they called up and said, we have selected your wedding as the wedding of the year and we are coming to cover you and put your wedding in Life magazine. Now I tell you, I was so thrilled. Now poor old Haverhill went into instant redevelopment. They tried the best they could to get everything straightened up. They swept the streets. They polished the statue of the thinker out front of the high school. They did everything they could. The principal began to speak to me kindly. People I didn't even know started to give me showers, and we had to reprint wedding invitations to get everybody in that wanted to have their picture in Life magazine. So everything, as it was going along very nicely, and the Life magazine came out, for 2 weeks, they followed my every move. Wherever I went, cameras were there, and so I had a grand opportunity to wear some of my Filene's dresses that had floating chiffon panels and marabou feathers over my shoulder, and I made grand entrances like Loretta Young all day long. Now, this was so exciting. Now, who could possibly have imagined anything more grandiose than to have your wedding in Life magazine? So as I thought about this, and as I got everything ready, I had not really had time to keep in touch with Fred and tell him what was going on. So he showed up the night of the wedding rehearsal. He was rather like a leading man in a play who had never read the script. So we worked him in, and as I came out of the church that night, I looked across the street to my father's little store, and I said to myself, Florence, you've done it. You've gotten yourself everything you wanted in life. You're totally educated. You're a gracious lady. You've got all of this wonderful reputation for your job and your affairs in the community. You're marrying this handsome young man with promise, and I didn't mention to you, but when I went to his house, I found out it was an English Tudor mansion with a maid in uniform. And I thought, now this is for me. That's what I wanted. I thought that was only movies, but when I saw that, I thought, that is for me. So here I'm marrying this handsome young man with promise, and now my wedding was going to be in Life magazine. Now, did any one of you achieve more than that at 24? See, I was so thrilled with what I'd done with me. Now, I learned, unfortunately, that wedding was the high point of my marriage. And I have learned a simple basic truth, which is the title of my next book, and that is that after every wedding comes a marriage. Now, you see, you can picture weddings. You can see pictures of weddings, but you can't really get a hold of a marriage. And I found out that when I got married, overnight I became stupid. Now, that happened to anybody else here? I went from being the urbane queen of Haverhill, Massachusetts, to being my husband's own private Eliza Doolittle. When I got home, he started putting me on a training program after the honeymoon. And I said, what do you mean a training program? And he said, well, you have to become the kind of woman that I want you to be. Well, I thought I already was. I thought I was perfect because I'd worked so hard to make myself that. And he said to me, you're not perfect at all. He said, the first thing we have to do is get rid of your Boston accent. I said, I don't have a Boston accent. Everybody up there talks like that. He said, we have to get rid of that. That's fine in Boston, but it will never go over in New York society. We have to get rid of your accent. So he began to teach me things. He showed me that I didn't walk correctly. I said, of course I walk correctly. I did some turns for him, showed him how gracious I was. And he said, you think you walk well, but your feet turn out. So then I had to practice every night on the tiles in our foyer floor till I could walk up and down 10 times without my feet going over the cracks. That was a lot of fun for a young bride. Then he told me I didn't answer the phone correctly. I said, hello. He said, what you have to do is say, good evening, this is Florence Littauer. With whom did you wish to speak? Now, I thought even for me that was a bit wordy. And then he would call me up 3 or 4 times a day to spot check my responses. I tell you, I was so grateful when after we'd been married a month that the Life magazine did come. And there it was, pupils help a teacher get married. I'll leave this upstairs at the bookstore so you can look at it. Pupils help a teacher get married. Admiring teenagers take over the ceremony. And the great thing about this was that nowhere in the entire 5 pages of glorious pictures of me Did they ever mention the name Litauer? It was all Florence Chapman. I was so happy that even Life magazine saw that I was the important one of the pair. Now, for someone who had done so well with herself, you'd think that I ought to be happy. As we got established in marriage, I found out that there really wasn't a lot of fun to it, that Fred really wasn't a bunch of laughs as my brothers were, that he sometimes corrected my stories when I strayed somewhat from the truth, which I felt was only colorful speaking. I felt it's only right that if someone tells you a perfectly dull story and you feel led to pass it on, you should fix it up a little before you bore the other people. We found out there wasn't much that either one of us had in common. We first got married, we went out for an ice cream cone. I wanted to go out for an ice cream cone. He said, we can't go out because you didn't ask me earlier in the day and it's not on my schedule. I said, what do you mean it's not on your schedule? He said, if you want an ice cream cone at night, you've got to ask me in the morning so I can put it on the schedule. I said, I don't know in the morning that I want an ice cream cone at night. Now see, this marriage did not go very well. And after a while, I found out that I had to do something to amuse myself, and I talked to some of the mixed-up girls in the apartment, and that's a good place to go for marriage counsel, and they told me the best thing to do is have a baby, it'll take all the pressure off. So I, see, some of you made the same mistake, so I had a baby, poor thing, the ugliest thing I've ever yet seen to this day. Bright red face, her nose was pushed way over to one side, her eyes met under the bridge of her nose, and her hair stood out like spikes all over her. She looked like one of those little clay heads you buy in florist shop, they plant grass on it. Just the way she looked, the wrinkles, the whole thing. And I took one look at her, and I knew that if I took her out, I'd have to put on a big bonnet, pull up the blankets, put up the back of the carriage, and hope nobody ever asked to see my baby. And by the time I got home from the hospital, my husband had read 3 books on motherhood. And I already found out that I was even a failure at that. So now here was someone who was really trained to be perfect, and I was all set and made myself wonderful, and how did I get myself in a situation where I didn't really feel very good about anything? Well, my husband suggested that maybe I should go out and do something in the world. So I decided, well, that'll be good. I'll go out and find jobs. So I went through all the things that Women's Lib tells people to do today. I went out and found myself before most of you even knew you were lost. And so I was out there doing all the great and wonderful things so that I could be exciting, be fulfilled, and find interesting occupations. And I always took on things, modeling, teaching, directing musical comedies. Whatever I did it in such a way that everybody was looking at me and telling me I was wonderful. And I found out that if I could find enough people to tell me I was great all day, I could stand Fred at night. So this is the way we function. So I had my one daughter, Lauren, who incidentally did shape up to be all right. If she was still ugly, I wouldn't even let you know I had her. But she shaped up. And I have some up-to-date pictures on the back of this Life magazine for you to see. So I had Lauren. 4 years later, my husband kept telling me that he needed to have a son, Frederick Jerome Litauer III. And so consequently, four years later, I had my second baby. And that day that I went to the hospital, I modeled in a fashion show before I went and had her. And I was so proud of the fact that nobody ever even knew I was pregnant. And so I could even do that well. So I went off to the hospital. I had my second child, and unfortunately it was Marita. It was not Frederick Jerome Litauer III, as it was supposed to be, and so I was disappointed. So I knew, once that I'd had the second one, and it was another girl, what did I know I had to do now? Another one. And I had not really gotten into motherhood. And so I was really not too excited about this. But I knew I had to have another one. So a year and a half later, I was at that time teaching speech at the University of Connecticut. And I stopped just long enough to go into the hospital and have my third child, who turned out to be Frederick Jerome Litauer III. Now, at that time, I was so excited about what had happened. And my husband came and he told me, finally, you've done something right. So I was grateful for that, too. So as I came home from the hospital with that child, I can remember standing there and holding him in my arms, looking out over my backyard in this beautiful, elegant home that I had in Connecticut. It didn't have columns out front, but it did have a fireplace in the bedroom. I had made sure that was built in. So I had a beautiful home. I'd bought 6 rooms, added on 6 more, made it into a beautiful suite of rooms. I had a Lincoln Continental to drive around in. By this time, my husband's business had gone so well, I had 3 fur coats. And I had the ultimate status symbol that I knew was going to make me happy, and that was having a maid in uniform. Now, at this point, when I held him, I looked out and I said, Florence, you've now got it. You've got everything you possibly could want, and you've got to be happy from here on. So I proclaimed myself to be happy. And I was for a few months. But as this baby got to be 7 and 8 months old, he seemed to do less instead of more. And as I began to look at him, there seemed to be something wrong with him. He didn't sit up well. He kept toppling over. He didn't seem to focus correctly. There seemed to be something that was out of line. And then in the night, he started screaming, throwing his little head back, and his little hands would get very, very rigid, and he'd be tense and screaming, and I couldn't comfort him. So finally, when he was about 9 months old, I took him down to my pediatrician. At that point, I was directing musical comedies professionally, and I went down to my pediatrician, who was one of my leading actors, and I laid this baby down in front of him, and I said, Dick, there's something wrong with this child. Figure out what it is. Straighten it out. Whatever money it takes, you just get it, and we'll take care of it. So he examined him. He sent me out of the room. He called in a specialist, and then they called me back in. And I'll never forget, as he looked at me, my good friend, and he said to me, "Florence, I hate to tell you this, but I think this child is hopelessly brain damaged. I don't think there's going to be anything you're going to be able to do with him. I think you might as well put him away and try to forget him and maybe have another one." Now, if you've ever had a baby that someone told you to put away and forget, this beautiful little child, the most precious of all my babies, beautiful blonde hair, turned up nose, dimples, looked just like my husband. And I looked at him and I said, "Dick, there's no way you're going to tell me this is hopeless. Somebody somewhere can fix this child." And I said, "You find someone that can." And he looked at me and he said, "Florence, this is something that your willpower and your money can't do anything about." Now, I'd never met anything in my life that I couldn't handle. I'd never met anything that my willpower, my determination, or Fred's money couldn't handle. And he said, "I don't think you understand the severity of this problem." We took him through Yale New Haven Hospital, through all kinds of tests, and all the answers came back the same. Hopelessly brain damaged. Put him away, forget him, and have another one. Now, I couldn't put him away and I couldn't forget him, but I could have another one. And I hated to admit defeat. I hated to admit that this had happened to me. That perfect Fred, married to perfect me, could produce anything but perfect children. And yet, we had failed. So I did have a fourth child. And while I was waiting to have that fourth child, I spent a lot of time evaluating my life. When you're sitting there holding a child who's having 10 to 12 convulsions a day, screaming night and day, you can hold him and look around the house, and it doesn't really make any difference that you've got 12 rooms of wall-to-wall carpeting. It no longer made a lot of difference to me that I had these custom-woven draperies I'd had in Denmark to match the mural on the wall. There was nothing there that I saw that really made a lot of difference. And as you know, when you're in a time of trouble, it really doesn't matter where you're sitting. It didn't make any difference if I drove a Lincoln, and I no longer got any thrill of being president of anything or wearing a fur coat. Because when you're holding a dying child, that's about all that matters to you in life. I did give birth to my fourth child, and while I was in the hospital having him, my husband put his namesake in a private children's hospital in northern Connecticut. And when I came home, little Freddie was gone. The room had been wallpapered, the crib had been changed, and there were nothing left of little Freddie. And we did the only thing we knew how to do at that time with depression, and that was to put it aside, pretend it never happened, and hope you could forget it. I threw myself into mothering this child. And for the first time in my life, I really became a mother. I watched over him. I determined that nobody in the world was going to harm that child. Nothing was going to happen to him because I knew I could be happy if only I could get one son who could grow up and be normal. So I hovered over him, watched over him, and didn't let anyone else touch him. When he was 6 months old, we got on a Valentine's Day, as I was preparing a little party for my two daughters, I got a call from the hospital saying that little Freddie had died. He'd strangled to death in the night. He'd had pneumonia and he couldn't cough. He choked to death. We went and had a little private funeral up in northern Connecticut, and I looked down in this little casket, this little emaciated child with little spindly arms and legs, laid out in charity clothes, a little faded, ripped suit that somebody in the community had donated. I think that was one of the hardest things for me to take, because I'd grown up in charity clothes, and I'd vowed I'd never let one of my children ever wear anything that wasn't perfect. But my son was laid out in charity clothes. As I said goodbye to that child, I thought, there isn't a lot left to live for in life, but I do have this other son. So I went home and I held him, I hugged him, and I determined I was going to make this child into the greatest boy that had ever lived. 1 week after I had buried little Freddie, I went in to pick up Larry, and as I looked into the crib, he didn't look right to me. And I remember putting my hand down over him and just waving it there, and there was no response. And I picked him up and I shook him and I screamed at him. I said, "Smile, smile." And he didn't smile. And I took him down to my pediatrician immediately. I went in, I said, "Dick, check this child right off. I'm afraid there's something wrong with him." And he checked him over, he looked at him, and within just a matter of minutes, he looked up and he said, "Florence, I'm sure it's the same thing." Now, I'm sure you can imagine that for somebody who was programmed for perfection, somebody who was able to control everything and make all the plans and achieve every single one of them and get way beyond what I've ever expected in life, that for me to have the problem of facing that again, I said to my husband, "I can't live through this again." It's amazing what we can live through. I took him to Johns Hopkins Metabolic Research Unit in Baltimore, Maryland, where they operated on his brain and found out he didn't have one. There was nothing in there to work with. They told us that he would only live to be probably 2 years old. Unfortunately, he lived to be 19. He just died 2 months ago. I have lived with that for all these years. Every morning, knowing that I had this little child in this hospital who was a hopeless vegetable. And when he died in February, he was just this big. At 19 years old. He'd never grown. He had skinny little arms and legs. There was nothing at all that mattered in that child's life. Now, at that particular point, I was depressed. Depression is a feeling of hopelessness, a feeling where there isn't any way to turn. there's nothing that I can do in my own strength about this. What do we do when we get to that point of depression? What do we do when we get to a point where there's no way to turn? I knew I would never be happy again because happiness meant getting these two children back. And I couldn't get them back. And since I knew I couldn't get them back, I was never going to be happy again. I was determined to never be happy again. At that particular point, my sister-in-law asked me if I would go to a Christian women's club with her. And I'd never been to a Christian women's club before. I didn't know what it was. And I figured it was a group of little drab old ladies in black dresses kneeling over a Bible in the corner. And I didn't really want to go to that. And the last thing I needed to be told at that point in my life was I needed religion. I'd already been religious. I'd done everything there was to do. I'd once won a Bible lotto quiz, so I knew I was a Bible scholar. I didn't need to have anybody tell me that I needed religion. But my sister-in-law kept badgering me and kept asking me to go. For those of you who are faint-hearted, keep badgering them and keep asking them to go. So finally, I did go one day when she told me there was going to be a fashion show. I figured if these religious ladies are interested in clothes, they can't be all bad. So I went to the fashion show. And I got all dressed up in a ruby red ensemble with a big turban, satin and velvet turban, big brooch in the front, high heels about this high, pointed toes, a cut velvet bag, all to match. I wanted to make sure when I walked in there that these religious ladies would know I wasn't one of them. And I'm sure they knew. The man that spoke that day told a story of a woman so much like me that I thought Ruthie had given him advance information. He told about a woman who was ego-centered, who was arrogant, who wanted everything her own way, who tried to achieve everything, and had pushed everybody aside and had gotten just where she wanted to be. And when she got to the top, and he counted off all the things that I had. And I had things. Did I ever have things? And so he counted off all these things. And he said, she's got all these things, but she's miserable inside. And when he said that, he looked right out in the audience, and he said, there may be somebody here today like that woman who looks great on the outside. And he pointed right at me. But he said, she knows she's miserable inside. And I thought, how does he know me? Why'd he pick me out of this whole group? Could have pointed to somebody else. He pointed at me. And that got my attention, and I thought, I'll listen to what he's got to say. And he said, what she needs to do is to present her body a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto him, which is her reasonable service, and be not conformed to the world. Now, I'd spent my whole life being conformed to the world. I tried to get the world to follow me. Be not conformed to the world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. And then you'll know what is that good, acceptable, and perfect will of God for you. Now, I didn't think there was any perfect will of God for me. I'd gone to church all my life, and how could a good person like me have problems like this happen? And yet that man seemed sincere, and I didn't have any other answers, and I decided, well, I'll give it a try. So I prayed that day with that man. I committed my life to the Lord Jesus. And for the first time in my life, I truly became a believer. I didn't just give the Lord an hour on Sunday or a little token, but I did as he told me. I presented my body a living sacrifice. I prayed almost sarcastically because I was so hurt. I didn't want to take any chances of believing too strongly and having it disappoint me. And so I can remember praying that day, sitting in this old mill restaurant in Darien, Connecticut, 10 feet from the bar. And I prayed sarcastically and said, God, if you can do anything with me, good luck. Now, it's interesting how my heart was sincere, and God knows when your heart is sincere. I just didn't dare give it all to him. But I did that day present my body. And for those of you that are looking to overcome the problems that you've got today, whatever they may be, whether it's one child in your situation, whether it's a husband who's off somewhere, whatever it may be, whatever your problems are, the first step towards getting over this is to accept, as it tells us in Romans 12, 1 and 2, that we are to present our bodies, all of ourselves, the total, complete thing, not just a little category or a little corner, but all of ourselves. Present ourselves a living sacrifice. Not a dead one, but one who is going to live for the Lord, present ourselves a living sacrifice. And that when we do this and are not conformed to the world, he will transform our minds. And oh, how I needed that done. And I asked him to transform my mind. And he did transform my mind. Many, many, many things happened in my home and in my life. We began to go to a church. I began to find out what the Word of God said. I began to apply it to my life. And as I began to learn this and accept it, I learned the second thing that's important in getting over depression. The first one is to believe that the Lord Jesus Christ came to save you and present your body a living sacrifice. The second point is to realize, as it tells us in 1 Corinthians 10:13, and this was a real revelation to me, it tells us in that no temptation or problem, or depression, or discouragement, or adultery, or whatever, has overtaken you, but that which is common to man. You aren't the only person that's got this problem. Now, I'm sure you thought you were the only person that had that problem. I thought I was the only person that ever had two brain-damaged sons, which to this very day, they have never put any label upon. I thought I was the only one. But that verse says that there is no problem that's taken you but that which is common to man. But God is faithful. I was not. But God is faithful. And he will not allow you to be pushed, tempted, troubled beyond that point which you are able to bear. And when I found that out, I found out I'm not the only one. I've had women come up to me after I've spoken and they've told me, I've got two retarded children. I've got three, I've got this, I've got that, all kinds of problems. I've heard more problems than I ever knew existed. And I found out that there is no exclusive problem. You may be playing your little game on a different stage. And in fact, I've had some women that when I told them this verse and shared with them, because they were sitting in such self-pity, thinking they were the only person in the world that ever had such a thing happen to them. And I said, do you know that verse, 1 Corinthians 10:13? It tells you there is no problem that you've got, but that which is common to man. Everybody else has had something, and there are other people with this problem. Somebody had it yesterday, somebody's got it today, and someone else is going to have that problem tomorrow. I've had women that were depressed, and when I told them that it was not an exclusive performance, that it was playing all through town, and they weren't on their own stage, and it was not an exclusive engagement, who got more depressed than they were before. Because the only thing good about their depression was that it got a lot of attention, and they thought they were playing on exclusive rights. That's amazing. See, God didn't give us a particular situation that was only ours. There's no problem taking you but that which is common to man. That's important for us to realize. This isn't the worst thing in the world that ever happened to you, and you can live through it. He's going to lift you above this, and he's going to keep you in a position where you will live through to the other end, and you will be able to bear it. So the first step is to really believe that the Lord Jesus loves you and present your body. The second step is to realize that you are not the only one with this problem. The third step, and this is perhaps the most important one of all, is to realize that you have to be willing to want to get out of this and to do something about it. I talk with so many depressed women who are so happy with their depression that they would be unhappy if they got out of it. I used to think, 12 years ago when I first started doing this and counseling with women that were depressed, I used to think, being a very practical-minded person, I used to think that anybody with a problem wanted a solution. Now, those of you who do any counseling know this isn't true. That most of the people who come to you really don't want a solution. What do they want? Sympathy. Because they're up here at point number two, they think they're the only one that's got this. It's become the focal point of their life, and they become so introspective and so involved with their own problems that they want to sit right there, and they really don't want to get out of it. Many times, depression with women is like an old bathrobe. You wake up in the morning, and you grab this bathrobe. Why do you grab it? Because it's comfortable. It feels right on you. Now, it looks terrible. It's got tears in it, and it's got bacon grease on the sleeves. We have dragged it through the pan. It looks awful. Your husband has said, throw it away. Your children said, Mother, that's a rag. But every day, you feel good in it. Now, see, it's a real negative situation, but you feel comfortable in it. That's the way a lot of people are with depression. They've wrapped themselves up in the bathrobe of depression, and they frankly don't want to get out of it for anything at all. Now, so many women I talk to are not willing to take the first step. So many of them say, if only my husband were better, I could be happy. If only my children were fine, I could be happy. If only I had a bigger house, I could be happy. Now, I've been the gamut of all sizes of houses and everything you can imagine, and I know not one of those things ever made me happy. I tried so hard, and I achieved so much, and I ended up so miserable. So, see, it doesn't make any difference, and I've got to be willing to accept the fact that this is where I am today, and I jolly well better get myself up out of this self-pity and get on with life. Now, I've talked to a lot of women who weren't willing. One lady came to me. She was very depressed. She'd been married three times. Her husband had been married three times. And when you got that kind of a thing and you're in a bad marriage situation, you better do something to get out of it. And so she came over to talk about it. And one of the things that was wrong was that she never did the laundry right. It's amazing the deep things you counsel people on. And so she's not doing her laundry right. And so I asked her, what's the problem? And she told me, well, that she does not like to do laundry, and her husband complains every morning because he can't find his T-shirts and his socks. And worse than that is she washes the white T-shirts in with the black socks. So this meticulous man has got gray T-shirts and white balls of fuzz all over his socks. And this is just one little symptom of their problems, but it's a simple one you can understand. And so I sat there and I thought, well, here I've got a great genius idea. And so I taught her how to do laundry. I told her how to put some bleach in the white ones and to keep the black ones away and take a little scotch tape and get the fuzz balls off. And I showed her all these deep and wonderful truths. So she sat in my office. And then I said, now go home and do that. You know what she said to me? I don't want to. She's not the only one that said that to me, but I'm just giving you one example. I don't want to. I said, what do you mean you don't want to? She said, I'm not willing to do that. I said, why? She said, because my husband hasn't done anything nice for me. Now, you see, if you got him sitting over here, and you got her sitting over here, and neither one of them is willing to move, there's not a bit of a chance they're going to ever get to the middle. Now, if one of them moves, the other one might come a little ways. Or if this one moves, the other one might come a little ways. But you see, she wasn't willing. I said, you mean you're not willing to go home and do the laundry, right? She said, no, I'm not willing. So I said, are you willing to be willing? She said, no. I said, you're willing to be willing to be willing. She said, well, I'll go along with three willings. I said, all right, then you go home and you take the verse, Philippians 2:13, and you accept that verse which says that God is always at work in you to make you able and willing to obey his good purpose. I said, is it God's good purpose that you two get divorced again for the third time? She said, well, I don't think so. And I said, well, I know it isn't. I mean, you've had enough bad troubles. Let's try to hold this thing together. So I said, you go home and you memorize that. God is always at work in you, you, to make you willing and able to obey his good purpose. And it's his good purpose you stay together, so you go home and you wash the socks. She came back the next week. She said, I haven't washed the socks right yet, but she said, I'm down to two willings. So that was a help. The next week, she got down to one willing. The following week, she washed the socks, and she came in and she said, I made a compromise with my husband. I've done the laundry, and I put it on the stairs, and he carries it up. Now, that was no great triumph in counseling, but at least the amazing thing is that after a few weeks of her doing the laundry, even though she only went halfway with it, he was so happy with her progress that he came one night to see my husband. My husband took him into the study, and he prayed to receive the Lord with my husband. Now, see, he became a Christian because his wife was willing to wash the socks. Now, see, as long as she wouldn't do that, he wasn't interested in any kind of spirituality that she talked about. See, she had to become willing to do what she was supposed to do. And this is where a lot of us have to be. One couple came to us, and they had a little farm that they had out somewhere, and they were both professional people, didn't have any children. They just played with the bunnies. And so they had this little farm out there, and she came to me, and they had problems. They had some marriage problems. And every night she went out and milked the cows. And he told me, he stood right there in my house, and he said to me, why would you want me to be romantically interested in her when she goes out at night to milk the cows, comes in, takes off her dirty overalls, smelly boots, drops them beside the bed, and hops right in without a shower? She said to me, well, there's another side of the thing. I was sure there was. And she said, it's because we had agreed that we would both milk the cows, and every night he sends me out and I do it, and he's in getting ready for bed. He spends a half hour getting lovely, spraying himself with cologne. I come in, he's lying out there gorgeous. That makes me so furious because I've been out there milking the cows and getting madder by the minute. She says, I come in, I look at him, so I throw the overalls right down. That turns him off for the night. Now, you see, now there's a simple little problem, isn't it? Now, any one of you could solve this problem. What would you tell him to do? Sell a cow, somebody said. That's you know, that's what we all want to do. We all want to sell the cows. That's the humanist answer. If it doesn't work, outright sell the cows. Move on. Get rid of the husband. Send the kids away to camp. Whatever it needs to do, get rid of the problem. But you see, where the cows, their problem. See, the cows don't even know about this problem. So the cows weren't their problem. So I explained it to them, and there were three ways to go in this problem. Number one, she could go all the way and do it all herself, which would mean that she would have to go out every night earlier and milk the cows, as long as she's going to do it anyway. Go out earlier, milk the cows, come in, take the shower, get sprayed with cologne, and get into bed. That's if she wants to go all the way, because right now we're sitting out here, the two of them. Now, if he wants to go all the way, he can go. He can tell her, stay in and get ready for bed. And he can go out and milk the cows, and then he can come in, take a quick shower, and they're both in bed at the same time. Now, see, either one of them can go all the way. Or even if they won't do that, they can compromise. They can both go out and milk for half an hour and both come in and shower for half an hour. You see how easy? Now, I thought this was such a simple solution. I laid it out for them and sent them packing and figured now they're going to be all set. I met her a couple of weeks later in the grocery store. I said, how's the overall game going? She said, just the same. He won't milk the cows, so I won't take a shower. Now, see, here's two people that are totally unwilling. Both depressed, both unhappy, and miserably ended up getting divorced. They were not willing at all to do anything about it. Now, see, you've got to be willing. Fourth thing you've got to do is be willing to confess to the Lord that you're in a mess. And a lot of us don't want to admit that. Because we want to say, I'm not really in a mess. It's because of that baby. It's because of that husband. It's because of this house. It's because of the lack of money. It's because of all your problems. It's not because of me that there's any problem. And we've got to find what part of this is my problem and confess it. It tells us in 1 John 1:9 that if we confess our faults, our sins, our problems, our depressions, if we confess, then he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Now we can boil that down to four words. If we, then he. Who has to go first when we're dealing with the Lord? We've got to take that first step. He's right there, ready to do it. But he's not going to perform a big miracle, so we'll believe. He wants us to believe, and then he'll perform a big miracle. So if we, then he. If we confess our sins, then he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. The fifth thing that we have to do is ask the Lord for joy. He does not want miserable, mournful, gloomy Christians hanging around. He wants us to do what is right, that we may shine, that we may sparkle. In Philippians 4:11, it says, Paul says, I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. Now that shows it wasn't early, easy. Paul did not have a great personality. He did not find it very easily to love everybody and to bounce through life. He said, I had to learn in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. In John 16:24, it tells us, hitherto have you asked nothing in my name. Ask that you may receive, that your joy may be full. God wants us to have joy. In James 1:2-3, it says, and I love this part, it says, is your life full of difficulty and temptation? Then be happy. For when the way is rough, your patience has a chance to grow. So let it grow and don't try to squirm out of your difficulties. Now see, we've got to face it and get on with life. Ask the Lord for joy. He doesn't want us to be miserable. The next one is to forget the problems that we've had in the past. To forget the past. Paul tells us in Philippians 3:13, he says, my single purpose in life is to forget what's behind me and to reach for what's ahead. Now, when Jesus Christ met the adulterous woman, he didn't say to her, honey, let's sit down and discuss your past. Pull up a rock over here, and we're going to discuss how were things with the first one. How'd you get involved with the second one? What went on with the third one? What were you wearing when you picked up the fourth one? Now see, the Lord Jesus didn't say that at all. He just said to her, go and sin no more. Now if you've got a problem and you go to a counselor and he asks you to sit there and recount all the details of every sexual activity you've ever had, get up and leave. Because this is not godly counsel. We don't need to spend our time rehashing the past. We don't need to go through all the intimate details with everybody we meet. We have to say, Lord, I know that all the past did was to serve me with a lesson of what not to do in the future. And pray, as Paul said, that your single purpose become to forget the past and to get on with what's in the future. I met a lady on the airplane the other day as I was flying over here. And as I sat next to her, she asked me what I was doing, where I was going. I told her. She said, what do you speak on? I said, I speak on overcoming depression. She lunged for me and grabbed me with both her hands. She said, where have you been? I've needed you. Now, I'm sitting there like this, and she's got a vice grip on me. So naturally, I asked her what was the problem. I knew she was depressed. She told me this whole story. The key thing in the whole story was that when her husband went in for open-heart surgery that she thought they both agreed that he should have, on the stretcher, as he went into the elevator, he looked back at her, and he waved, and he said, just remember, this was your idea. Now, this was not a nice thing for him to say. But it was 5 years ago he said it. And when she told me about it, it was like it was yesterday. And she's hanging on me and her nails are digging into my hands. And she's saying, that's what he said to me, and I'll never forget it. Now, as I asked her, did he recover? Yes, he recovered. Is he happy? Yes, he's happy. Sounded like he was kind of a joker, and that was kind of his way of saying goodbye. And but she couldn't get over that, you see. She's going to remember that forever. She will not get over that. And she said, he wants us to have fun. But she said, I can't forget what he said to me. Now, she's going to hang on to that and me for the rest of her life if she possibly can. One girl came to me, she told me how terrible her husband was, and then she told me about this letter he'd written her once. And then she said to me, in case you don't believe it, I got the letter right here in my handbag. She said, I've carried it in my handbag for 12 years, and there it was with all the torn edges on the thing. She said, I keep it right in my handbag in case I ever forget what he did to me, I'll remember it. We have to forget what's behind. Let's not brood on that. We have to then keep our eyes on the Lord. It tells us in Isaiah 26:3 that thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in me. Where's the depressed person's mind? Where's their eyes? On themselves. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee. Not on me, on thee, because he trusteth in thee. We have to keep our eyes on the Lord. And when we do all this, we get the proper results. In Romans 8:28, it tells us that all these things, no matter what they are, do work together for good. Not to everybody in the world, but to what people? To those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. When my son, my adopted son, that we adopted later, when he was 12 years old, he said to me, Mother, I'm really sorry for the problems you've had with your two boys. But he said, I just realized that if it hadn't been for that I wouldn't be your son today. He said, somebody would have had me, and I would have lived somewhere. But he said, I wouldn't be your son, and I might not be a Christian today. So I don't like to say in any way that I loved what I went through. I could never say that it was fun and games, and I don't want any one of you to go through it. But I do know that while the Lord does not cause these disasters, he makes the very best he can out of them. And that we remember that all things do work together for good to those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. Our family loves the Lord, and he has definitely called us to his purpose. Now, as you leave here tonight and you think of your little black cloud that you're carrying around with you, ask yourself these questions. Number one, have I really ever presented my body a living sacrifice? Romans 12, 1 and 2. Do I really know that this is not the only and worst problem in the world? 1 Corinthians 10, 13. Do I give a willing spirit to the Lord? Am I willing? Philippians 2, 13. Am I willing to confess the part of my problem that's up to me to do something about? 1 John 1, 9. Have I asked for joy, and do I want the joy of the Lord to be exhibited in me in spite of adverse circumstances? Do I want that? John 16, 24. Do I want to forget what's behind me, or do I take the greatest pleasure in digging it all up day after day and spreading it in front of everybody I can find to tell? Am I willing to forget the past? Philippians 3, 13. Am I willing to look at the Lord? Isaiah 26, 3. Thou will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee because he trusteth in thee. And do I realize, as in Romans 8, 28, that all things do work together for good to those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. Last week I spoke on depression at a retreat, and a lady came up. She made me a little black cloud. And it has a loop so I can hang it over anyone's head. So here is a little black cloud. But I want you to remember that behind every little black cloud, there comes a rainbow.